Quit eating your burgers off a coffee table. If you want to eat a burger, put it on a bar. Follow your instincts to B-Dubs for the new All-American Cheeseburger. Fresh, juicy beef smashed till it's crispy around the edges, covered in gooey cheese, and stacked to the ceiling with deliciousness. And knock that baby down with a frosted beer at the bar, just like the sports gods intended. The new All-American Cheeseburger at Buffalo Wild Wings. Roar! Please drink responsibly.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have the return of our ex-heavyweight champion of bitter culture. Hasn't been here for a long time, Sharad Kutan.
Always a pleasure to be here, Cam.
Well, it's great to have you. And another returning, hasn't been on the show very often, but he's pretty good.
Nowhere near heavyweight champion status. I didn't know I was playing with heavyweights today.
A bantamweight.
Yeah.
Ezra Zide.
Hello, hello.
It's a very BFM show today. Very in-house BFM.
Yeah.
And so our three topics this week will be: topic number one is the pressure to be adventurous on holiday. Topic number two is May Day. And finally, topic number three is old buildings, knocking them down. Good thing or bad thing? And so with topic number one, it just so happens that today, after recording this show, Sharad and I are going off to Sri Lanka, to Colombo.
Thanks for the invite, guys. Thanks.
Yep, sorry.
Hey, you can still come along. in my vanity case.
It's a quick jaunt away to do a bit of shopping in a wonderful town. And I'm happy to do that. But the thing is that Sharad's actually, he's got a dilemma. He has a five-week sabbatical coming up, and he has talked about nothing but where to go on his holiday.
And changed my mind endlessly about it.
Endlessly.
Too.
It's been Trans-Siberian Railway, Sarawak, Ipoh, it's been everywhere.
Wow, we went the whole gamut there. That you don't say Sarawak and Trans-Siberian Express in the same sentence usually.
And he wants to do it in the same
Pan
week.
Pan-Borneo Highway.
All right.
And Trans-Siberian.
But the thing is, I think that Sharad is feeling the pressure that I feel as well. I think many of us do, that our holiday must be adventuresome, and it must be meaningful. Whereas when I look back on the moments when I've had on a break, it's been very sedentary. It's been like sitting down somewhere, drinking a coffee, and not doing anything.
Yeah.
But I feel guilty nonetheless when I'm doing that. I should be climbing that mountain. I should be going to that other place and that kind of thing.
Okay, well, the distinction here is that the holiday we're going to take in Sri Lanka is going to have no purpose other than pleasure, right? But when you put the word sabbatical next to leave, then there's pressure because it's supposed to be a kind of learning period. It's a gift from the company to help you expand your horizons. That's where the pressure comes from, right?
No, I don't know. Even if you were going, if you had a two-week break, a regular two-week break, you would still feel that pressure.
Yes, I guess that's true, because you want to make the best of it. An adventure seems something out of the ordinary. Since you want to get away from the ordinary, then the extraordinary becomes important. But how do you get the extraordinary? You can't buy it, you see. This is the problem.
But what's really interesting is, you know, I have these exact issues as well when I go traveling, be it with family or friends, and you're always caught in that in between of, should I really have a great time tonight and just forego all the historical and cultural things that I might discover tomorrow? Or, come on, Ezra, you're only here. When's the next time you're going to come visit this particular location and actually absorb so much of this new smells and sights and sounds? And more often than not, back in the day, I used to power through them, because I would tell myself, you got the legs, you got the energy, absorb, absorb, absorb. But of late, I've been leaning towards, Cam, what you were saying, having a cup of coffee, enjoying the moment, rather than, you know, downloading my brain with so much information.
Welcome to middle age, Ezra.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
I wonder if that was
the energy decelerating. No, the other thing, of course, is that, you know, and what exactly is an adventure? And I think, so it could be whether it's pleasurable, you know, whether it's educational. It's only an adventure when there's a kind of dramatic arc, right, in the thing. And then you can tell a story, because you really can't come back from a holiday and tell people about how you drank coffee. I mean, just really there's no plot development. I mean, it just sits
there.
But
do you feel the pressure, though, that you must come back with tales to
tell?
Exactly. Well, I think we all become storytellers because of things like, so, you know, Facebook and all that. We all feel the need to say something that we did that was extraordinary and have a narrative around it.
Especially with the advent of Instagram, where people feel that you're almost giving a tour guide of what your activities
are. And justifying it.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
that it was more exciting than anybody else's. I think there's a competitive edge to this as well with the adventure. But I think not all of us are really storytellers, as some of us more than others. And I think, unfortunately, for those who feel the need to entertain others, and there may be a couple of those sorts in this room, you know, you need to have a good tale. I mean, you really need to come back from an experience and say something. And it was like, you know, get everybody, you know, who's in the living room with you or around the table.
But there's also the destination choice. So for me, for instance, I mean, it's really expensive, but I do like to go to Europe. I really enjoy going to Europe. Whereas I know that I probably should go to like Sumbawa or Lombok.
I've been there.
Yeah, exactly. See,
Sharad, it's exciting. We were doing election monitoring, and it was, you know, 1999. Country was up in flames. Yeah. You know, there was a smell of tear gas in the air. Yeah. You know,
with a hint of democracy.
Yeah, yeah. No, democracy was surging ahead, but you know, all these forces of reaction.
You've got that, Sharad. Wow. So you're always going to like be above everybody else, the rest of humanity.
I mean,
your choice of where to go, is it not feeble compared to that?
Well, no, it's very much now dependent on how I feel. So because I take that into account more so than what I've done or where I've not visited. If how I feel towards a particular occasion, like a holiday or a sabbatical, where, all right, let's get into it, let's explore what Mongolia has to offer, then I'm set to it. But Ezra, you know, there are a lot of conversations with myself in my head, clearly. Yeah. But it's about whether, you know, you actually want to take a vacation that has hints of educational, informative bits. And I usually tend to like those more than going out on a mission nowadays. I mean, the best example was I went to a holiday with my family a couple of years ago. We went to Hawaii. Now, Hawaii, what are your impressions? It's beaches.
Macadamia nuts.
Yeah. Yes.
Volcanoes.
Right. And so we did all of those things in a very relaxed fashion. But then we came across the royal family of Hawaii, where they had a palace in the middle of, I can't remember whether it was Oahu, but then you go in, you go, well, you think America, you don't think royal family. And so it was a nice little encounter that I spent 2-3 hours, you know, going around the place. And it was a fun time, but it wasn't something I was looking out for when I
departed. Did your father then decide to liberate the royal family and pursue their cause for independence
and stuff? There's a word for it when you encounter something they didn't expect, serendipity. And because serendipity is also the ancient name of Sri Lanka, right? So before Sri Lanka, there was Ceylon, and then there was Serendip, right? But still, it's the kind of the idea that you encounter something. And my first trip to Sri Lanka, and Mike, the only other trip I've done, it was because I went to election monitoring yet again. And but suicide bombers, you can imagine.
Get on with it.
But the payoff of the experience is what should matter to you. I mean, I understand the storytelling aspect of it from a particular and recounting all of these moments, but the payoff has to be personal first and secondary. For everybody else, surely.
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, I actually stayed on after the job was done, and I wrote a piece called From Slave Island with Love.
There you go. So, to wrap up this one very quickly, Sharad, now, what are your sabbatical plans now?
Clear, I'm not changing them unless somebody's got some better idea. Pan Borneo Highway. I'm going to travel to Sabah and Sarawak and really understand that part of our country. Yeah.
Ooh. Sounds good. Great. I like that.
Okay. So now, talk number two, Sharad. May Day. My fist is clenched in the air.
Well, it is May, and May begins with Labor Day or May Day.
Of course.
And I think we should remember why we commemorated and the struggles of the working class, which was pretty much everybody at some point in time.
Could you give me a 15-second primer on why we're celebrating Labor Day?
Well, I think it's got to do with the 8-hour workday, I think. Okay. I think, and I don't really know. It's caught up with the 19th century and the 20th century labor struggles, right, around issues of class, consciousness, and stuff. But I was thinking about that. I was thinking, what else can I talk about when it comes to that? And I'm just thinking of left-wing movies that I've watched that had to do with labor. And I Googled a few sites, and they have lists. And they're a bit bizarre, including, you know, that American movie 9 to 5 with Dolly Parton, you know, working 9 to 5.
Yeah,
that's right?
A feminist classic, that one.
See what I mean? So it's feminist, leftist, and the person put this damn list together thought it was anyway. And I could see it, but I was thinking more in uncompromisingly lefty, but sort of mainstream. And it's Norma Rae. When I think of Norma Rae, which is a movie that won Sally Field an Oscar,
from the 80s, isn't it?
Yeah, from the 80s, and she's a labor organizer in a textile factory. And there's a classic moment in it because these are not. See, they're not Marxists and communists all over the place. It's just ordinary people thinking about what would be just for them. Just kind of simple, Nobody's reading the Communist Manifesto in this movie. And at one point, she gets up on the shop floor, right? She gets up onto a machine and she holds up this manila cardboard sign and it says, "Strike." And, there's this whole kind of build up to that moment, but it's just electrifying.
Sounds very un-American. Didn't it?
And I think it's very un-something. It's very un-Malaysian. I mean, how many have either of you remembered a strike in Malaysia?
In Malaya?
Yes. But remembered. I mean, actually lived through it.
Oh, lived through here? No, cannot.
Yeah, strike. We're quite old.
I have been. I mean, I remember driving past people and they were on strike and beeping in my solidarity, but I can't remember what it was.
I think somebody went on strike by not posting, pictures of cats on Instagram. I mean, that's the most I've experienced.
Yeah. And also, it's not just like a bank, workers in a bank who might have had a strike at some point in time, but the kind of strike that stops a city, it disrupts everyday life. That kind of strike.
Yeah, but are you lamenting this? I mean, what if it's not necessary?
No. I'm not lamenting it because I love my creature comforts and the idea of disrupting that, because that's what. Now, this is the thing. This is the odd thing, right? So if everyday life is disrupted, people kind of like, well, don't really like these people. They're making life difficult for the rest of us.
I read quite a few strikes that happened in pre-independence Malaya. And in the lead up to independence, while the different communities were negotiating their position in a new independent there, and it was as if independence, that moment of independence, then was the cure to everything. Whether or not it actually was, but it was officially a moment when it was like, okay, all of this now can stop because we have independence. It's done. And I wonder if we still carry that sense that independence has been the solution.
Well, what's interesting to that is that, when you speak about strikes, and I was trying to think about, have I seen a strike in my time? But in fact, the more contemporary manifestation of that, and it's not really the same actually, but it's a protest. We do protests and NGOs do it almost every day now. You do a police report, you have a little press conference, and there's a whole sequence to it. Yet the end result is not nearly as tangible as what we would see in strikes of yesteryear.
Yeah, in fact, I think, the closest we've come since independence time is, of course, the Bursay rallies, right? The major, quite disruptive, kind of taking over the city and casting the city in a very different kind of light. And but again, it's more like, the protests that we see now, mostly that television seems to like, are those big democratic protests, right? Thousands of people calling for. I mean, that Icelandic prime minister, had to step down because of the Panama Papers, or things of that sort, right? But when I think of a strike,
people
today,
power kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like the problem is, democracy is everybody's story. It seems as independence was, right? But the strike, in a kind of a traditional sense, is a labor strike. The idea of May Day, which again is about labor and the struggles of working class, I think for a lot of middle-class people, it seems like somebody else's strike. It seems like a very partisan or a rather sectarian kind of phenomena.
Because it's not their fight, so to speak.
Yeah, you know how it is, we don't see it. Because it, maybe at a time, the world's changed so much, it seemed at one point everybody was a worker, except the people, the few people who weren't. But now, you know, workers are like those people who work in a factory. You know?
And also, a lot of people have non-strike clauses in their contract anyway. So
do they?
Yeah, well, not about this country, but certainly in once strike-ridden Britain, now you can't actually, you cannot strike.
Ah, this is interesting because I was recently watching House of Cards by the British version, and you know, in the early 80s, there were a lot of strikes. So the winter of discontent was under Callaghan, wasn't it? The Labour Prime Minister.
Just before Thatcher.
Yeah, so that's what, the late 70s.
Yeah.
And, so you were around
in the
70s.
Strikes all the time.
What was it like?
I'd be sitting there and then suddenly the whole house would be plunged into darkness. And you'd go through the list. Okay, is it the coal miners? Is it the electricians? And it was actually rather exciting.
Well, right now, of course, in the UK, they've got the doctors as well, right? And their working hours, being debated.
This is the first ever strike by the NHS, National Health Service.
And it's a huge thing because, you know, in social media right now, I mean, that's also, you know, the strikes and these gatherings have gone digital. Mm-hmm. It's gone in the, you know, the formation of words rather than the formation of bodies and people.
Well, you know, but they don't do House of Cards, American version, Frank Underwood, first season, teachers strike. And he seems to break it with fried chicken. It's very unfortunate. I think it was very damaging to, it's symptomatic of our failure to empathize with the working class.
And it just does seem rather old-fashioned now, doesn't it? Like an old-fashioned story. But anyway, we must move on. And so in a moment, though, we shall be talking about old buildings. How exciting. Here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Sharad Kutan, and Ezra Zayed. And now, Ezra Zayed, old buildings, should we knock them down or not?
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to talk about this is because, you know, Urbanscapes Festival, I think it's in its 14th year or 15th year. I'm going to stick with 14th year.
That's positively ancient.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, one, you know, congratulations to the team who, a creative festival that's lasted this long in the Klang Valley. I think that's always something really, really positive because a lot of these festivals have spurts and moments and they don't sort of last the whole gamut. But what they're really doing interesting this year is that they're making use of different spots in the city. It's not a one-day, two-day kind of thing. It's spread out over a long period of time. Quite recently, they had a gathering and where they always have a lot of exhibitions and a lot of, art exhibitions and stuff like that. And they actually had one in a rather old building. And I'm trying to think whether it was a bank, and it was off Jalan Tun Perak or Jalan Hangkasturi, that particular area. And you go in and they've changed the space into a rather avant-garde experience. There's a DJ, but there's balloons in a jail cell. There are skateboards with images of past and present political leaders. It was an entire experience, but it took me a while because they occupied all three levels, the basement, top floor, and the ground floor. And it took me a while to realize, I was just looking at the furniture of the place, it seems like an old civil service type space or a bank and I was thinking about how useful or interesting it would be to actually monetize or use some of these spaces in a more practical and contemporary way.
Okay.
I enjoyed it. I mean, that was my takeaway from it. It was just so...
And if we can't, we just should pull the damn things down. Is that it? Is that the conclusion?
Well, you know, we're not great with regards to our appreciation towards things or buildings. I mean, we would be happy to take down, a building that would be 50 or 60 years old that would be integral to the story of how Malaya or Malaysia came about if the right offer came about.
I mean, just any excuse just to knock it down.
That's right. Yeah.
Penang's had some unfortunate incidents. I think the last year, some buildings have been lost. But okay, I mean, if we talk about this in kind of like just that core question of tearing down something that's old, right? What about Palmyra? If you think of what ISIL did in bombing Palmyra, right? That ancient Roman capital.
Yeah, but they were not going to knock it down to replace it with Putrajaya or something.
Yeah, that was
what we don't know.
They didn't have a master plan.
Yeah. You know what I mean? No, I mean, there were.
Does that make it any better?
No, there wasn't a master plan. I think it makes it different. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a master plan to build something else in its place. It's not like just going to, I don't know, Ipoh and just leveling the whole place.
But, you know, there's something. Okay, so it was a gesture to say we don't care about history and we don't care about the history that you care about. We're only concerned about our history and perhaps our future, right? I think that was generally what the gesture was.
And they also do not advertise themselves as being constructive in any way, but merely destructive.
No, I think for the people who participate in ISIL, they do see it's constructive. They're constructing God's paradise on earth.
Okay,
you know,
so in a non-materialist way then.
Well, you know, okay, but the idea is, and I remember reading this book about Egypt and the pyramids, and many pharaohs dismantled the pyramids of the pharaohs that came before them in order for material, right? And so they didn't have a kind of fetish for the old. They didn't care, you know. They weren't thinking, oh, this is part of our built heritage and we must preserve the memories. They wanted to create a memory for the future. And so, but now, of course, when we encounter the built legacy of the pharaonic age, we worship it. We think we must preserve it.
Well,
right?
Because legacy now plays so much more of an important aspect to it, because you can I guess people are conscious about recording history and their place in it. I mean, I remember, you know, going to Greece for the first time, and, you know, I had visited other parts of Europe where, for my 4 years of undergraduate studies of studying history and politics, when you arrive in Greece, you're going, hello, here we go. We're going to have a visit to Aristotle and Plato. Let's see where they hung about and had
the cradle of Western civilization.
Yeah, let's have a look. And I got there. And of course, somewhat underwhelming because it's ruins. But at the same time, I still felt that I was part of a particular moment, going back to this whole discussion about being on holiday and having something to share with on Instagram. Yeah. I felt that it was crucial that I can't remember me taking any photos of it, but I just enjoyed the moment of being at the marketplace of ideas.
Yeah, because also what you were rather not experiencing, you were not experiencing the conscious, deliberate destruction of that past.
Yeah.
The denial of that past, which is I think what we see here in this country.
Well, you know, when I first went to Athens, I mean, the only time I actually been to Athens, my earliest memories are of a very dark airport and then a rather seedy hotel with rather women of the night offering their services to my brother and his friend myself, and us sort of running away into a very cold room with rats.
Which part of Athens did he go to, and which one did I go?
I was on budget.
One of Sherrod's traveler's stories. And we will be doing a series of Sherrod's traveler's stories.
But okay, the thing is, okay, I think the consensus is we must preserve something of our built heritage, because those narratives bind us together, right? They give us a sense of common identity. If we didn't have them, then we would be perhaps less cohesive as a society, whatever that really means, but we would.
I mean, for me, you know, and I don't know the details of whether it was true or not, but you both do remember where the conversations were being bandied about the taking down of Stadium Merdeka. The fact that that conversation even took place really spells out, you know, how very little concern we have, but because we don't even have that much history to begin, because we're a very young nation. And yet at the point in which we achieved our independence, yeah, what do you think? A couple of condos with a nice swimming pool and a nine, you know, it just seemed unfathomable that would be even to be discussed.
Okay, but we are a young nation as a modern nation, but we're also quite ancient, right? So if you think of Lumbabujang, you think of the ruins there.
Sure,
and,
absolutely.
And remember the very vociferous debate that happened over the accidental, I think, destruction of a chandi, a temple.
Accidental.
Well, so, yes. And well, that was the air quotes that I couldn't actually manage, you know.
Oh, you mean it was verbally. First century? How did I know?
There's a lot of work has been put into excavating Lumbabujang, I believe. And actually, the Kedah Royal House is very ancient, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, again, you know, the dilemma is, we want to preserve, but we also want to have space to build, and we want to think about the future as much as the past. I mean, these seem to be perennial perennial debates around every instance where something is going to be torn down. We need to ask ourselves, is it really worth preserving or should we move on?
I think you're using the argument of the person who would wish to preserve. So, I mean, and you gave a good argument why that would be the case. You know, it gives us a cohesive past, etc. But the actual argument, the most important argument in this country at the moment, the dominating one, is the argument for the destruction. And we have to kowtow to that argument, which is the past doesn't matter. You think you know your past. No, you're wrong. It's my past.
And most Egyptian pharaohs, you know, when they tore down the pyramids of their predecessors, thought the same thing.
No, absolutely. But they were not even theoretically living in a theoretical democracy. I mean, they were living in an absolute monarchy. We are supposed to be having a nod toward a thing called democracy.
Well, a nod is as much as we can go.
But
just give it a nod.
But let that building stay. That's a nice nod.
Okay, so it's a consensus, right? So democracy is built on a consensus. What is the consensus in Malaysia? Consensus in Malaysia is we want modernity, and you know, maybe in the most banal ways, all the trappings, the escalator, the lifts, the airports, the shiny new glass and, you know, steel edifices, whatever. And that is preferable to the old creaky stuff, right?
You know, I'm always thinking about, you know, a gentleman who's on sabbatical who works in a media organization, let's say in a neighboring country, and he comes to Malaysia and wants to, you know, have an adventurous 5-week holiday. And I think, you know, in 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now, I don't want to be limited to bringing them to the Petronas Twin Towers. I mean, whilst that would be a great experience, you know, where else can I bring them to show different pockets of the city that you know, give a nod to yesterday?
Can I just suggest SS2 Mall? It's been abandoned, and it feels like a ruin. It's actually a modern ruin.
It's a modern ruin.
And people should be doing tours of abandoned shopping centres. I think, in fact, I'm going to go out the soonest possible moment and pitch this to the people who own SS2 Mall, if they're still living in the country or they, you know, they aren't in receivership and, you know, have their lips sealed, and say, hey, can we do tours of this abandoned mall?
Yeah.
And you know what'll happen? It'll just be like, oh, ghost stories and stuff. It'll be like, you know, it'll just be that.
Yeah, the ghosts of, ghost. You know, of shoppers, you know, trying to make decisions over clothes.
We must move on. Sorry, Ezra, you want to
Well, I just wanted a quick question. You know, Pudu Jail was like in the heart of town. It got torn down. How do we feel about that? Was that...
I mean, it was not a happy place.
Yeah,
not a happy place.
But you know, 20 years from now, it'd be a buzzing place. You know, where people go, "Wow, look at all of this."
Yeah. Well, you know, I went for a tour.
How was it?
It was very interesting because I went with lawyers, and they and they mapped it out for us about,
yeah,
you know, and it's cruel, and this describes a kind of philosophy of human beings and what punishment means, right?
Which
but it was a beautiful building,
which
they preserved.
That's
it.
That's right, and that was exactly my case. Yeah.
Okay, well, all right. Last word for me is the word beautiful, and if it gets knocked down, but if it's replaced by something beautiful, then that's one thing. But it's like 9 times out of 10. It's not. So anyway, we must move on to the last part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that might be of interest. I'm going to go first. My recommendation is, this is going to like blow your mind, Sherrod, because you're going to be like so haughty and like, this is just not good. But anyway, I'm a big fan of, admirer rather, of Ulysses S. Grant, the American general from the American Civil War. And 2-time president.
I should be humming Dixie, shouldn't I?
No, you see, Sherrod's already sneering at this. But I've always been
Look away.
I think he's one of the greatest generals of all time, and a very modest man. And I've always been reading about how great his memoirs were. So finally, I was in a bookshop, and I finally found a copy of his memoirs. Started reading, and it's really good. His memoirs, which were written in the final 11 months of his life, he knew he was dying and he had to leave some money to his family. He bashed out these memoirs, and they really genuinely are the best memoirs of a major, certainly military figure I've ever read. And
I wish I was in Dixie.
You see?
No, I think it's brilliant.
It's
brilliant.
Don't be patronizing, okay?
Anyway. No, absolutely.
You guys are going to have a great holiday together. Let me tell you that.
The
point is, his memoirs, it's just beautiful writing. And I'm trying to decipher what is good writing through reading it. It's very to the point and very clear, and it's a wonderful history of the U.S. Civil War.
And is it an easy read for folks who are interested in American history? But because American Civil War is so... it's such a beast, isn't it, when it comes to encapsulating all that took place. Is it a nice little...
I think so. Yeah. I think so, because far too often the Americans eulogize their war with heroic warriors and valor and honor and rubbish like that, where he doesn't talk like that. I mean, he just like just gets on.
He's an English writer then.
He's American. He's a Victorian writer.
Oh, he's a Victorian.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I'm patronizing. That's all I can say, Sherrod. So that's mine. Ulysses S. Grant, his memoirs. Sherrod, what have you got?
Okay, maybe I'll do something similar, because there is a very interesting man, W.E.B. Du Bois, who really, you know, lived a very long time. I mean, he lived out to his 90s, I believe, and was a man who theorized the color line. You know, he has a book like The Negro and such. I mean, he's just a very important Marxist, African American, but you know, polyglot and autodidact, and I don't know, just everything, an amazing. Unfortunately, I have volume 2 of his memoirs, and I'm sort of looking for volume 1 because I really don't want to start in the middle of the story.
Right.
But you know, there's something to be said about living long, because your memoirs can be quite substantial.
All right.
So that's William.
So W. E. B. Du Bois.
Why did I say William? Well, because it's William, isn't it? Yeah,
is
W.
Is W. William? I don't know, actually. I could check it out.
No need. Du Bois.
It's a bit of culture. We don't do research.
No. Absolutely, folks, if you don't know that by now. Ezra.
What I have is in the medium of radio and podcasting. There is a very, very famous podcaster in the U.S. He's also a very famous comedian by the name of Mark Maron. He has a show, WTF with Mark Maron. He interviews a whole host of folks, and you know, it hit its peak recently when President Obama actually rocks up to his garage for an episode of WTF. So he does President Obama, he does sports people, and he does comedians. And he does comedians very well, because Mark Maron himself is a comedian. And one of the more interesting conversations that I've heard recently is his discussion about comedy with Sacha Baron Cohen. Sacha Baron Cohen, a lot of people might know from his work as Borat and Ali G and Bruno. What was interesting about the interview, apart from the fact that Sacha Baron Cohen doesn't do a lot of Sacha Baron Cohen interviews out of character. So this is probably the longest interview that you'll ever hear. And what you discover is a guy who is so conscious about pushing the boundaries of comedy on television and what he does in that medium. But he's also very he's very educated about the traditional forms of comedy, about what the role of the jester was in the royal household. And it's an amazing discussion about comedy, to how it affects society and people. But again, when you're hearing all of this information, this is the guy, Borat, who would like just be in a toilet wearing flowy, bright underwear. I mean, it's a very contrasting image when you actually see Sacha Baron Cohen's work and actually hear his process about what he's willing to go through to get somebody to laugh.
I'd love to hear that. Well, what's the podcast called again?
WTF with Mark Maron, and look out for the Sacha Baron Cohen interview.
I find Sacha Baron Cohen very problematic. I'm not a fan.
Yes, and I think if you're
but
not
but I'd be fascinated. No.
And if you're not a fan of Bruno and Ali G and all of his work, this would definitely be an interview to listen to, because it goes a bit of culture deep into the world of comedy.
Okay, so that's WTF with
Mark Maron.
Mark Maron, check that out. So that brings us to the end. Only remains to now to thank special honored guests returning all too rarely, Ezra Zide.
Thank you very much.
And Sherrod Kooten, the original.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And myself, Cam Rustin. You can join us on our new Facebook page. And also you can download our podcast from bfm.my/bitofculture. Do so. And whilst you listen to the WTF podcast.
Yeah.
And also, well, I don't know about you folks, but I've started an Instagram.
Have you?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I've got like 5 pictures. I keep forgetting. When we go to Sri Lanka, I'll add a few.
Yeah.
And you can check out the Instagram. Ezra, do you have an Instagram?
I do. It's at Ezra Zide.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you also have a Twitter feed.
Twitter account that has the same handle at Ezra Zine.
And you're not Instagramming, are you?
No, I do have one. I don't use it. I'm only on and active on Twitter. That's at Sherrod Kooten.
Okay. So, that's the way to get in touch with us. Join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Quit eating your burgers off a coffee table. If you want to eat a burger, put it on a bar. Follow your instincts to B-Dubs for the new All-American Cheeseburger. Fresh, juicy beef smashed till it's crispy around the edges, covered in gooey cheese, and stacked to the ceiling with deliciousness. And knock that baby down with a frosted beer at the bar. Just like the sports gods intended. The new All-American Cheeseburger at Buffalo Wild Wings. Roar! Please drink responsibly.